today I'm here with Sean Collins, who is the founder of Affiliate Summit. And Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and your background?
All right. Thank you, Adrian. Yeah, so I've been an affiliate marketer since 1997, and I got into that after a stint out of college working in magazine publishing, mostly for technology titles back in the 90s, and then was looking for something different and joined a startup back in 97 called MedSight, and they were basically trying to emulate what Amazon was doing but with medical books. So I had been an affiliate for maybe 2 weeks at the time, so I knew a couple buzzwords, and they were looking for an affiliate manager. And I had no background at all in marketing, or never took a business class or anything in college. I was a communications major, but they gave me the job there because I was willing to work for cheap, and I knew some of what they were talking about. So I sort of made it up as I went along, starting as an affiliate manager dating back to 97. And then I ended up doing affiliate management for about 10 years for various companies and also on my own. And then along the way, I realized that there wasn't really a good trade show out there for our business. And I had met my current partner, Missy Ward, at a conference. And we were talking about the need for a trade show. And it didn't really make sense for the two of us to start up an event because neither one of us had the experience, but we just had the zeal and the passion for it. And so we got Affiliate Summit going back in 2003. And back then we got a free space at Baruch College in New York City to run it. We just had 200 people there. It was just a very small event that was really cobbled together. And then most recently we were at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas this past January. And we had over 5,000 people in over a couple hundred booths and tables from sponsors. So it's come a long way.
So, and you're originally from New York, and now you live in Texas, right?
Yes. Yeah, I lived in New Jersey and worked in New York City for many, many years. And then back in 2010, I just was realizing I was getting more and more frustrated with just the crowds and the taxes and the weather and everything of the New York area. And I had visited Austin, Texas for South by Southwest, and I just fell in love with the area and decided to just pull up stakes and move the family out here.
Oh, so you moved to – I've read about people going to South by Southwest and then moving there. So that you actually did do that?
Yeah. I came here in 2009, liked it, and then 2010 we sold our house and moved. And it just for a variety of reasons, just like to get away from the crowds and the weather, the taxes, but also just it's just beautiful here, and it's a very highly charged entrepreneur environment with lots of big companies here and a big tech crowd. So it's just good all around.
Are you actively doing much stuff locally though?
Yeah, I run for the past year and a half, I've run a monthly meetup on marketing throughout Austin, and then I attend a lot of other meetups, and any conference that comes through town I go to, and so I regularly attend and speak at events here, so I've gotten pretty immersed into the whole community here.
And do you prefer it now compared to New York?
It's really night and day because while there are certainly opportunities in New York, when I was in New Jersey, I was, I guess, about 20 miles out. But I so rarely went into the city for any kind of like community type things. I would go in there to work, but I wasn't really making it out to meetups or different things like that just because it was such a hassle with the trains and everything, and to drive in could take a couple hours even for that short span of distance. So I wasn't really benefiting from the good things that were happening in New York because of the barrier of the bridges and the tunnels there. Mm. So it's sort of a whole rebirth here with getting involved with people in between my conferences.
And is your tax situation a lot better being out in Texas?
Oh, it's tremendously better. So I went from paying 9% state income tax in New Jersey to zero here. Hmm. So that was a nice raise. And also just the standard of living is just the cost of living is that much lower. I have a house that I love that costs less than a house that I tolerated in New Jersey.
Hmm. Interesting. So, you started, Affiliate Summit now is a pretty big conference. So you said you have 5,000 people attending?
Yes, yeah. We had over 5,000 back in January 2013.
And you do two a year, right?
Yeah, we do two big ones a year. So we do an East Coast and a West Coast one. But then we also recently started up a sort of a smaller brand we're calling Performance Marketing Summit, where we just get together a couple hundred people, and we're going to do that, just take that around different cities we don't otherwise usually visit. Just so it's a sort of like the farm leagues for Affiliate Summit, where we'll hit maybe like we've never been to Chicago or San Francisco, some other cities, so we want to make it there and just just get the brand out there more.
And so, I mean, the question I'm really interested in is, how does one start a conference like this? I mean, you guys got free space at Baruch College and put 200 people in a room. I guess you and Missy were both pretty dialed in, so that was easy enough for you to do.
Yeah, at the time, we just leveraged a lot of relationships. So we started, I'm sure, the wrong way, because we didn't know about any of the vendors or anything to use, or maybe a lot of them didn't exist back then, 10 years ago. But we I got that space for free, just in exchange for giving a couple passes to marketing students at Baruch College. And then I was running all their registrations through my own PayPal account and manually sending out confirmation emails to people as they registered. And it was a very handmade, do-it-yourself kind of setup there. We stuffed all the bags ourselves and just everything we did by hand. And at the time, it was about 2 years after I'd written a book on how to manage an affiliate program. And so I managed to build up a pretty nice list from that. So I had a forum for affiliate managers in this book and an email list. So I was able to tap into that to bring people out. And then Missy had her connections as well. So we were able to fill that room. And then just by word of mouth, we just kept building it up from there.
And so that was the first one. When did you do the second event?
So the first was November 2003. The second one was in June 2004. And that was a different sort of thing. It was a mistake that we haven't repeated. We did it on a cruise ship. And so it sailed out of New York City up to Halifax, Nova Scotia and back.
What, did everyone hate each other by the end of the trip?
No, it was the networking was amazing. So it was 5 days where we just all jammed together for every meal and everything. And so that was wonderful. But the issue there was that we couldn't get any big brands to come along because they just figured it was a boondoggle. And so we sold it out with 230 people there. The space didn't allow us any room for any kind of exhibit hall or sponsorships. We just had one banner hanging up that we were able to sneak in there. But the cruise just gave us a lot of headaches. We thought we were going to have a totally private area, but the entire time they refused to let us lock the doors, and they had guests from the cruise ship walking through our room. And in some cases, there was an older gentleman while a speaker was on. He walked in and literally stood 10 feet in front of him and was listening to him in front of the whole audience there. And I had to get up and sort of usher him away. And then another point, there were a couple guys that were presenting, and we were right below the disco, and there was sort of an open air access to look up to it. And we were assured the whole time there would never be any events there during the day. But they went back on their word there as soon as we set sail, and they had children in there every day screaming and shouting and stomping. And so for this one session, they had Britney Spears music blasting, and we had to keep going up there and fighting with them to get that off. And so it was sort of entertaining in retrospect, but it was very frustrating and embarrassing for us trying to build this company at the time, dealing with these kind of silly things.
So you went from there. Then what did you do after that time?
After that, we started what we've done ever since, is we polled our attendees and asked them where we should take the conference next. And so we've done that every time since then. For now, we've done a couple dozen of them. And they also said they wanted to go to Vegas. So we waited a whole other year until we did the next one, which was in June 2005. Or maybe I'm misremembering it. I think it was January 2005. It was June. Sorry. And so we headed off to Las Vegas then. And we learned another mistake along the way there. We had a company approach us that I forget how they found us, but they said they would take care of all the logistics locally, and they would book the hotel for us and everything. And so I had never been to Las Vegas at the time, so I didn't really know one hotel from the next. And so they sold us on the fact that they get us great deals at the Riviera. And I don't know if you've been there before, but it's sort of a dump.
And so that one didn't work out that well. But yeah, I guess through all of this, like, people keep coming back.
Yeah, well, despite the hotel, we were able to keep growing the numbers, and people are happy, and we built it up, and it kept growing from there. But we learned from that we didn't want to rely on any other third parties to take care of such an important part of the conference. So that sort of set the stage for us always being very hands on and taking care of all the details and not outsourcing important things like that.
So that's something I was interested to ask you. Now, I guess I had assumed that if you run a conference, you would just like place a phone call to some logistics people and they'd set everything up for you and you'd show up with the conference. But you're saying that you tried that and it didn't work, and so you don't do that.
Yeah, and I suppose there's a number of ways you could go about it. With us, we like to really handle all the details, and there's some things that we happily outsource, like the people that we have a whole army of people that we hire in each city for security and for registrations, all the folks that staff the booths and check people in and give them their attendee bags and everything. And we get everybody to ship to a third party to stuff the bags that we hand out. But in terms of actual negotiating contracts and picking the spaces we're going to have and the actual rooms we'll be in, we like to do that ourselves just to make sure that it's what we want.
So, I mean, who sets up all of the things like where people sign in with their badges and the sale of the badges and handing out the bags and all that stuff? Is that a third-party company that does all of that for you?
Yeah, so it's a variety of third-party companies. So we have a staffing agency that specializes in conference folks in Las Vegas or New York or anywhere, that they'll bring all those people in there. And a lot of these people we've had for years since we've been going to Vegas so long. And so we get a lot of the same people that come out and help. And then there's a company called Freeman. They're one of a couple of different decorating companies that we usually use. And they set up all of those sort of booths that you go check in at to get your badge. And also they do all of the setup of tables and booths in the actual exhibit hall.
So is this now like a well-oiled machine? You know, now we're 10 years later after you started, you just flip the switch and it goes? Or is it still like total stress time and putting out fires?
I'd love to say that it's a well-oiled machine, but it's still lots of putting out fires and also just the process of trying to keep building it and growing the audience, because we've managed to grow it every year for 10 years straight. So just continually marketing and trying to innovate and change things and improve it. So it's and we've kept a very small staff all along. So it's myself, my partner Missy, and then we have just two full-time people. And to run the whole thing. Plus, in addition to the conference, we do a quarterly magazine called FeedFront. And so all of us, we just do all that. We bring on a designer to do the actual design work, but we do a lot of the writing and then all of the editing for the magazine, all the copy for the headlines and everything.
So outside of your magazine, what are the four of you guys doing all year round? I mean, because it would seem like there would be a lot to do 8 weeks before the event and getting the event set up, but the rest of the year you kind of have a long holiday. Is that not the case?
That would be wonderful if that was the way it worked. But we, each of the conferences has, I guess, about a year or so horizon leading up to it. So there are a lot of details to deal with. Like right now, I'm just totally buried in all kinds of things working with the speakers we're going to have for our conference that's still, at this point, 5 months away. And so just dealing with all of the getting them all the signed agreements and working out the schedule of when they're going to speak and all the topics and getting all the panelists signed out and everything. It's so that sort of thing just takes up a lot more time than you might imagine. And just the dealing with all of the catering and everything, and like it's taken us quite some time just to, like, when you walk in and see the exhibit hall, it seems nice and easy and orderly, but we've been working with the fire department in Philadelphia for quite some time now trying to get as many booths in the space as we can and get it all approved and going back and forth. And so it's a lot of back and forth with a lot of the local people there in the convention center and the fire department and the decorating company and the caterers. And then also just all of the people that are all the sponsors, a couple hundred sponsors, and then 100 or so speakers. So a lot of moving parts there that need to be constantly attended to.
Are you dealing with unions as well?
Just in terms of writing big checks to them. But
well, that's nice of you.
Yeah, it's not really optional, unfortunately.
How does that work? Like, for, I don't know anything about unions. Like, what do you have to do with them, and what can't you do with them?
I guess they have certain rules. Like, you can't, like, you have to have them carry tables and things in certain areas, and you can't, like, for instance, on the exhibit hall floor, you can't just wheel in your own cooler full of beers to give out. You have to buy them through them for like $9 a bottle. And so they you have to buy everything through them, the furniture. Unless you have your own furniture you can bring, you have to rent furniture from them for a premium, and you have to buy food and drinks through them and have them carry your things in and pay a premium for all these different things you need them to do.
And does this go to is the union like a company, or is this goes straight to the employees? Like who is the union?
I don't know, like, which union the people there belong to. We're just paying the particular vendors, and then it gets filtered down to the employees there.
So it goes to the vendors, and you have to use certain approved vendors who are all members of one big union.
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. You know, I guess they might be in multiple unions. I don't really know, but we don't deal directly with the unions. Just that they are union workers.
Right. Would that do they increase your costs a lot by having to deal with all the union stuff?
Well, even in the hotels that are non-union, they really charge a sort of insane amount of money for all the different services there, all the food and drinks and coffee, internet, electricity, everything. So it's it doesn't really make that big of a difference. It's expensive either way.
And so, I mean, so there's four of you working on it. I mean, are you able to take much time off each year, or do you tend to be working year-round flat out? Because you're doing two conferences a year, I guess, and now you're adding these other smaller ones. I mean, is this keeping you flat out all year round?
Yeah, it's really all year round, but I think also we've sort of fashioned a lifestyle job for us, so we'll take off as we want to or need to, but also just working pretty feverishly too. So in addition to the conference and the magazine, I do a weekly podcast, a lot of videos, I blog daily, and I'm just constantly doing things to market the conference. And I just do a lot of speaking things. I had my own meetup yesterday, and I spoke and presented at that, and I spoke at another one a couple weeks ago. And so it's really pretty nonstop, but also at the same time, I spent the first half of today out with a friend of mine sailing on a lake here and just getting some fresh air and enjoying myself, and once in a while checking my phone, but not really working. So it's managed to really enjoy myself, but also get a lot done.
And so Missy lives in, she was at, working with Scott Richter, wasn't she? So is she out in Colorado?
No, that was, she worked with him for, I guess, a couple or so years a while back. So, I guess maybe 2003 to 2005 or so, but, she's always lived in Florida for as long as I've worked with her. She's in the Orlando area.
And so you have four people total, and so where are you? Are the two people, are you all distributed?
Yeah, the two of them, they're both in Virginia, and they're actually friends there. They live in the same area. So we pretty much just all see each other at the conferences. And otherwise, it's just mostly communicating by Skype or IM or phone or email.
And so you've gone from 200 people to 5,000, so that's obviously a pretty good growth. I mean, is that 5,000 per one of these two seminars per year?
Yeah, so we have an east one and a west one, and so the west one's usually a bit bigger. So we have, I guess, usually it's about maybe 20% bigger in the west than it is in the east. But it's a total of, I guess, 9,000 or so in the last year for people.
And so who are your competitors? I guess AdTech is your competitor.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how far you reach in, because we cover a lot of topics. So, like, you could say AdTech, LeedsCon, BlogWorld, PubCon, SES, SMX. There are just a whole bunch of them out there that we compete in big or small ways.
Right.
And I guess also the networks themselves, like Commission Junction, Linkshare, Google, ShareASale, they all have their own network events as well. So at the end of the day, people have to, they can only attend X amount of shows. So they're all competing with us for the dollars for those affiliate marketers.
So we need to tell everybody not to go to any of those other conferences and just to go to Affiliate Summit, right?
As long as they think that Affiliate Summit's worth it for them, we're constantly trying to fine tune it. That's one thing we pride ourselves on, is that we're always asking for brutal criticism so we can change things that don't work. And if people hate certain speakers, they just aren't welcome back. We're just always trying to make things as useful as possible for the attendees. So we love hearing when people are upset. I guess we don't love hearing when they're upset. We love knowing that they're upset so we can fix it.
And, I mean, can you talk about, in terms of the dollar volume, how big the conference is?
That sort of thing is, since we're not public, we don't share that.
I know, it's just my job to ask anyway.
Sure.
And so, I mean, one that I was pretty interested in was Jay Weintraub founded LeedsCon, like basically out of nowhere, built it up over a couple of years and then sold it. Seems like he did well with that. Is that something that you guys have considered?
We've had plenty of people court us over time, but we really enjoy being our own bosses. So that's not something that's really particularly attractive to us. I spent many years working for other people and didn't really care for it. So now that we're our own bosses, I really sort of can't imagine anything different than that.
Hmm. So you'll just keep doing this forever, basically?
Not sure about forever, but for the foreseeable future, because we're just really, like, we don't really look at it as a job. We just really, it's a very fun hobby that we get paid for.
Hmm. And what are the things that make it fun for you? Because, like, some of the things that you've described, like, for me, the idea of having to deal with unions and catering and stuff like that would make me want to stick pins in my eyes. But working with the speakers and stuff would be quite interesting, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess Missy deals more with the contracts and that sort of thing. And then I'm more involved with – I deal with all the speakers and with the site and do just a lot of the writing of our blog and coming up with different marketing ideas and things. So I get to mess around with different creative ideas and have fun with that versus being like more involved with contractual things and negotiating with people. Because that kind of stuff, I can't really handle myself. It's very unpleasant to me.
Right. Well, it sounds like you got things worked out well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because Missy and I couldn't really describe what each other does. We just happen to cover everything, and it works.
And yeah, I guess you know because it does work. So yeah. So in terms of the growth, so you went from the boat to the Riviera to then started to settle down into a more orderly growth, I guess, and it has continued growing. What were sort of some of the other interesting lessons that you learned along the way? Like that, you know, your story on the cruise ship is a pretty interesting one with some of the things that happened.
I guess the one thing that we came across that was, I guess, surprising, but in a way, but not really. We were finding that there are a lot of companies that wanted to have more of a presence there, but they couldn't really come up with the money to buy a booth and to just buy the booth itself, plus the space from us, and bring all the staffing out there and everything. So we came up with this idea back in 2006. Where we started what we call the meat market, which is on the first day of our conference, and it's sort of a mix between an exhibit hall and a like a job fair. So instead of having booths, we have all tables there, and so it's it costs a good deal less than a booth, and it's something where you can just have a single person staff it, and it goes for 6 hours, and so that was really meant to be for the companies that couldn't afford the expenditure of a whole booth. But over time, we've found that not only do the small companies want to do that, but also all the companies that are in the exhibit hall, they want to have presence there too, because it gets such a big crowd and just such a lively part of the conference.
So this is like your version of co-registration.
Yeah, in a way. And it's the funny thing was that it's one of those things where the first time we tried it, we couldn't get anybody interested, so we gave away free tables to all the people that had booths, and maybe about half of them showed up, and it was sort of a bomb. So we wonder whether we should try it or not again, and we gave it another try, and it was successful, and it's been successful ever since. It always sells out, even though it had sort of a slow start. So it's so that was something just where we just listened to our audience and tried to give them something that they said they needed, and it really panned out.
Why do you think it didn't work out the first time?
I think just because it was a combination of it being a totally new thing that people weren't used to doing. And also it happened to take place at the same time as the World Cup was going on. It might have even been the finals that day. It was a Sunday in 2006. And so a lot of people were in the hotel bar instead of coming in there to do business. So I guess but one thing we learned from that is that we don't want to lose people to sports in the future. So a lot of when we do go to Las Vegas, it's usually in January, usually during the NFL playoffs. And so what we've done the last several seasons is to get a projector and a TV connection and a big screen, and we play the games in our meat market so people can watch the football games while they're doing business and they don't have to leave us. And we also bring in bars there so they can have the bar environment in the meat market, so they have business and beer and football all in one spot.
Did you expect that this would become the size that it did when you started that thing at Baruch, or were you just saying somebody needs to do this and let's do it? Like, was your intent that you guys would form a 10-year partnership working together and running this thing?
I'd love to say that I could have predicted it would have exploded like this, but at the time we just wanted to have something for the industry to get together, and we'd never seen anybody else have events that were more than maybe several hundred people at the most, so we didn't really know what the capacity was, and I was conference friends with Missy, but I didn't even know her that well, so the whole thing, there was no way to really predict that it was going to just multiply in size so much and that we'd be great friends and doing well a decade later.
So you hadn't even really worked with Missy before, so that could have been a train wreck right there.
Yeah, and certainly I've had other partnerships I attempted where it just didn't work out a month or two into it, but with us, we've just melded together, and it's worked out really well for all this time. And I think part of the magic for us is that we both work from home, and so we're both sort of intense, but I think if we're in the same office, we might kill each other. But we have, but having 1,000 or so miles in between us, it's been good for our relationship.
And do you guys only see each other at conferences as well?
Yeah, pretty much either our conferences or else we'll both attend the same conferences oftentimes. In the past, we've gone to AdTech or Blog World and other shows at the same time and attended them. So we'll go there sometimes, exhibit or just attend. And so we see each other there at other shows too. So I guess probably see each other maybe 5 times a year.
Right. And this meat market thing you mentioned, that sounds like, you know, something of an innovation in the conference industry. Like, where do you learn innovations? Like, what are innovations that happen in your space?
Well, I guess one of our biggest strengths and maybe even weaknesses is that since we didn't really have any background at all in the trade show space, we just made up things that we thought would be good that we would like to see at conferences. So we haven't really paid attention to like the trade magazines for trade shows or anything of that sort. I went to one trade show, 4 trade shows in New York City years ago, and the only thing I came away with there was that how backwards they all were in terms of embracing technology and things. I guess it was probably 2009 or so, and they were all I think I was the only person in a room of about 200 that raised my hand when a speaker was asking who was using Twitter to communicate with their attendees. And we've been doing it for 2 years at the time. And everybody there was totally foreign to the concept of using social media to promote their conference and to communicate with their attendees. And so everything they were talking about, just it seemed so antiquated, like it was like the playbook of how to run a trade show in the 80s or something. So I think it's sort of, I guess maybe there's some things that we've missed along the way because we didn't know the quote-unquote correct way to do it, so we just made it up and figured out how to do it probably more efficiently in a lot of cases. So all we don't really ever go out there and like advertise in any way. Like once in a while we'll exhibit, but like for instance, years ago we started buying some ads. I guess it was in the DM News a while back. We got a full page ad, and they're pretty pricey. I don't even know if they're even around anymore. I haven't seen a copy in quite some time, but that was sort of the way that our magazine started, because we were realizing that we spent so much for this full page ad. We could have put out a magazine issue of our own where we could have had a bunch of editorial that was useful as well as just promoting our own company. So that sort of was the seed for us to start our own magazine, because I had some background in there from the 90s working in magazine publishing. And so we figured instead of paying somebody else to run our ads, let's run our own ads in our magazine and we'll build the list up. So now we've got 35,000 or so people that get this in their mailbox 4 times a year with our ads in it.
Oh, interesting. So that's you're sort of probably one of your main promotional vehicles for the conference then.
Yeah. So instead of paying somebody else to run our ads, we run them. And then we also have other people paying to be in our magazine. So we make a profit off of the ads we run. We basically, other people pay us to help us distribute our ads. In a sense.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Yeah, I like to – it's funny because I talk to a lot of people who they say they don't know how I fit it all in a day, but I I can't imagine like not being, I guess part of its efficiency is because I used to work late into the night, but I cut that out because I just figured it was killing me. So now I start about 8 in the morning and always end at 6 so I can hang out with my family and have dinner and everything. And so I just work pretty much that. I jump my iPad and my phone plenty and check in on my emails, but I work really sort of a traditional day and have breaks in there. I'll go out for a hike or a bike ride or play out in the water or take a dog walk. So I'm not sitting there glued at my desk for 10 hours straight, but I just try to be as efficient as possible instead of working long, crazy hours.
One of the things that I like in business is to be able to be figuring hard things out and doing innovation. And this is one of the things that kind of drew me away from the conference idea, because it doesn't seem like you're necessarily innovating a lot. Or are you, and I'm missing things?
Well, I guess we're always trying to reinvent the wheel. Like, for instance, one problem that we've tried to address over the years and we still haven't figured out the right solution for it is that when you go to a conference and you have Q&A at the end of a session, you have some people that are going to go up there and they're self-promotional and they spend a minute saying what their company is all about before they ask their question. And you get some other people that they stand up in the back corner and they don't go to the microphone. You can't hear them. And then still some others will go up there and they'll ask some question that has absolutely nothing to do with that session and they're just totally confused. So we tried to get everybody to embrace this method we had, where we're going to have people just all either text or post their questions or tweet them, and then we'd have them all compiled, and then the moderator or the speaker could just look at them and they could answer questions that were posted up to a screen there in the session. But we tried this for a while for 3 or 4 conferences, and people just didn't adopt it. They just didn't like the idea of doing that. They just wanted to keep asking questions to the microphone. So that's still a very imperfect way, I think, to ask the questions, because I think it chases away some people that are a little bit shy about getting up there at the microphone, and other people, like for the reasons I was mentioning, that it ends up being sort of a circus. But so that's something where I think there needs to be some innovation, and we're still trying to figure out the best way to do that.
It would seem like Twitter's a great approach, because it would keep the questions very concise. But I guess if people don't like it, they don't like it.
Yeah. And some other things that we've changed up is that one thing that we were noticing from talking to people dating back to our early years was they were saying that they're frustrated because sometimes they'll see a session they really wanted to see, but it's competing with another session, and so they hate they have to pick one, or else they have this killer meeting they want to attend, so they have to miss the session or pick the session or the meeting. So we started back in 2006 just bringing in a whole crew and videotaping every single one of our sessions. So at this point, we have hundreds and hundreds of hours of sessions. What we do is, for certain past types, we make all these videos free, I guess about a month or so after the conference, after they're all produced. So we actually encourage people, which is sort of counterintuitive for a lot of trade show organizers, we encourage them to skip our sessions if they have any better reason to do something else, to whether it's a meeting or another session or what have you, so because they can always go back and watch that session later on, the recorded version. And I mean, if I'm going to watch a session, I want to be there in person, because I want to partially to meet the speakers and to expand my network, but also just to, if I want to ask a question, I can ask a question in person there. And so it's just a sort of a different feel, but we like to have this recorded version for people that can't make it for whatever reason, or in some cases they just want to sleep in. And so we've used that as sort of a subliminal advertisement for us. After about a year or so, we post them all for free on YouTube. So we've got hundreds of hours of our sessions on YouTube with our logo on them. So people are able to experience our content, and then presumably, hopefully, they enjoy it enough they want to come out and see it live.
What are you seeing that other conferences are doing that you guys aren't, that you might think about adopting in future?
Well, I guess we'd love to get an app that is a perfect app for networking and for scheduling and everything. Still looking around, and we've tried like a different app almost every show for the last 2 or 3 years. So I guess I'm not sure if there is a perfect app out there, but I'm assuming there must be one that we haven't discovered yet. So I think there's got to be some better networking some better way to facilitate networking, but we're always in the hunt to figure it out. So I love going to trade shows and seeing what kind of ideas I might be able to adapt. Like, for instance, we at South by Southwest, they democratized the whole process of picking the sessions there, and we started doing that a few years ago because I was concerned, because Missy and I were really picking all the sessions for many years, and we had a concern that we maybe had tunnel vision about the topics that should be included or the speakers who are the best. So we decided to start making it a public vote as well as a vote of our advisory board, which is about 30 people in the industry and different aspects of the industry. And so so we have all these votes and we crunch them together to decide who's going to be speaking. So we got that from South by Southwest, and I like that a lot. And that's imperfect too. Some people try to stuff the ballot box, but it's a good barometer to see what people want to see covered. And there are a lot of sessions that have been hugely popular that I never would have picked if it was my choice. So we've tried to make it as open and democratized as possible, not only with the session picking, but the cities we go to. So, like, for instance, we had been in New York City for the last 4 years. Now we're going to Philadelphia, and a lot of people are asking us why. And one thing is that we can't really answer that because we put it in the hands of the people. But one thing we found from talking to a lot of people that voted for Philadelphia was that we have a pretty big delegation of people that come in from Israel to Affiliate Summit when it's in the East Coast. And it turns out there are only 3 airports that have direct flights to Tel Aviv in the U.S. There's LAX, one of the New York ones, and then Philadelphia. So it makes it easy for certain attendees. And also, some people are saying they'd love to see it in Raleigh and different cities, but a lot of people don't want to pick that because they want to have a nonstop flight. So there's so many different factors that go into the cities there. So we like to sort of crowdsource our speakers in our cities to sort of follow along that old axiom that the customer is always right.
Is it that easy for you to do it in a different city? It's not an extra run-up time or much extra time to getting it to moving to a completely new city?
It's much easier for us to stay in the same city, but I'm always happy to move, and I'm excited about Philadelphia just because we'd been in New York for 4 years, and I mean we've been in Las Vegas for like 8 years now, and so I'd certainly be happy to move away from Las Vegas. I'm not a gambler and I'm not a big foodie, so the city doesn't really excite me at all, but our attendees seem to love it, or at least that's the most popular one that a lot of them love. There's some other ones that would love to go to San Diego or L.A. or San Francisco, but the biggest crowd always wants Las Vegas, and that show keeps growing, so I don't want to question it.
What's the process that you use for people to vote on where they're gonna be?
We've gone through a couple different things. These days, we just use a plugin and a WordPress theme that enables people to go there and vote, and it's sort of like a dig or a Reddit kind of thing where they can just vote up certain sessions.
So you just put that up and then suddenly like a whole lot of people voted on having the conference in Philadelphia and you're like, what the hell? And so you went ahead and now you're doing it.
Yeah, well, for the location vote, we have that in our feedback survey after each conference. So the feedback we collected after our 2012 conference in New York City, that was where Philadelphia got picked. But then the sessions themselves and the speakers, those are picked just on a website, on just like with a plugin and a theme. But we just use like a survey software to compile all of our feedback.
Right. Have you, I mean, I guess you are expanding. I was going to ask if you've would think of launching other businesses out of this, but I guess your main thing is to build the seminar and keep that strong. And then you do other things around that, such as the magazine and the meetups and some of the other stuff you do. Does that sound right?
Yeah. And we also have a site called geekcast.fm where it's a podcast site where anybody in the industry is welcome to come there and start their own podcast, and we'll host it for them. We'll distribute it. So we've been doing that for about 6 years. And we have the site revenues.com, which is a big news site it's been around for quite a while. It's a place where anybody can come in there and they can apply to be sort of a blogger correspondent to write about different issues with search or affiliate marketing, email, CPA stuff. And so we've got that going on, and we tried our hand at doing some book publishing, but weren't really happy with the results there. We started up our own imprint, and we put out one book, but just the overhead involved, it wasn't that attractive to us.
And I mean, I guess when seminars get bought, like, at a sale, like for selling the business, how what sort of prices is a conference actually worth? Like, I don't even have any concept of how you would value one. I mean, do you know how much leads con sold for, or you know what businesses do like this in your space?
Yeah, I never even bothered to look at what they sold for. I'm not even sure if it was publicized, and I really don't know anything about the whole merger acquisition thing or how you even would make establish the value of an event. That's totally out of my realm, above my pay grade to figure that kind of stuff out.
But I imagine you get in people coming to you from time to time, surely, because you have a lot of visibility.
Yeah, over the years, people have approached us, but the conversations just haven't really gotten that far. So we weren't really comfortable sharing our data, and we were a little bit concerned they just wanted to kick the tires. So we just figured it's safer just to keep the books closed.
Yeah, I mean, you've got something that you enjoy doing, and I mean, let's say you do go and have a big cash out. Well, then what are you going to do with all your time? You know, it's like I was talking with your wife might not want you around all the time. You know, she might prefer you're often working on stuff.
Well, she's had me living or working from home since 2004 anyway, so she's used to me stalking around the house all day. My intention was always, dating back to being a kid, was to be a writer. So I've got a novel on me that I've been meaning to start up that I have notes on, dating back to the early 90s. And I also intended to be a journalism major in college, but that didn't work out just because I focused a little bit too much on partying. And I got booted out of the journalism school. But I always thought it would be just a lot of fun to be a newspaper writer. But I guess by the time I get around to that, there may not be newspapers anymore.
No, and it's interesting because, I mean, a lot of affiliate marketing is lifestyle businesses anyway, and so you guys are running the conference as a lifestyle business to lifestyle businesses, more or less.
Yeah, and that's one thing that for the longest time, I always preached to people that a great thing about being an affiliate marketer is you can live anywhere, but it took me so long to be unhappy with where I was living to finally actually take some action and move from New Jersey to Texas. And I wish I would have done it 10 years earlier. I was telling everybody else, like don't live in some cold, damp place you don't like. Move out to a place that's a paradise for you. But I wasn't listening to myself for a long time. But it is certainly a lifestyle business, and I love that. Like, for instance, my meetups, I do them at noon. I meet a bunch of people, and we just go out and just take it easy and have a – like yesterday I spoke to, I guess, about 45 people in my meetup about – how I outsource a lot of things to Fiverr. And so it was just a fun laid back. It didn't feel like work. I was just sitting there just chatting with this crowd and eating some pizza for a couple hours about using Fiverr. We were just exchanging information. It was just sort of like a big mind meld there, a big mastermind. And it was just enjoyable. It wasn't so – and then I just did some errands and then meandered back to my office sometime in the afternoon.
So any tip for someone thinking about starting up a conference on what they should be thinking about when they do it?
Well, I guess the biggest asset for us starting up was just to be involved in the community that's focused on that conference. So since we were already immersed and we were already part of the community, we had those connections to know who would be a good speaker and to know who the people would be that we should try to get as sponsors and things. So I think it would be tough if you just walked into it blind and just figured that a certain niche is going to be lucrative and try to start a conference there without any kind of connection to the people. So
right.
I think that's really essential.
You have to be part of that community.
Yeah, and also I'd say it's a very good idea to start small and just let it grow organically. And I mean, at least it worked for us. I've seen some people that came and tried to compete with us over time, and they tried to go from zero to like 2,000 people in their first show, and they took a lot of risk on, and there certainly is a lot of risk in this business. Especially when you start dealing with big hotels and big cities, if you don't fill that hotel and hit all your numbers, you're going to be in big trouble. So I think to me, like, the slow and steady wins the race is probably the best thing to subscribe to when you're getting going. And so like our very first one, we started the company with zero investment outside of $7 for a domain. It was just hosted on a hosting account that I already had for my affiliate sites. And we didn't even incorporate until a couple years into it. So we literally had zero investment outside of that domain. We got started.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, and so you get to do things your own way. You're your own boss.
Yeah, and that's one thing I love, the freedom of it, is that if we, it's pretty rare that Missy or I veto each other on an idea. We pretty much, if we come up with something we think it might work, then we'll go out there and try it out. Sometimes it's hugely successful. Sometimes it's a total bomb. But we just try everything and see what works. And if it works, we double down. And if it doesn't work, we forget about it, move on.
Yeah. Cool. Anything else you want to share with us that you haven't told us?
I guess the one other thing that I just did recently, which is just based on my experience for years in affiliate marketing, is I'd been intending for a while to try out getting a Kindle book going, and I had a bunch of content that I put together on how I'd create my own affiliate sites. So I threw together all this content and I put it up as a Kindle book. And I was surprised at how easy that was for anybody who's considering that. I just basically had it all in a Word document, and I went to Fiverr.com. And I found somebody that was willing to format it for Kindle as one of the Fiverr gigs, and I got somebody else for $5 to create a cover for me.
You're getting a whole ebook formatted for $5?
Yeah, there's a lot of people I was looking, and part of the reason why I wanted to outsource it was I had Jeremy Shoemaker, who goes by Shoe Money. I was talking to him, and he was saying how it was sort of a hassle to deal with the specs and converting it over to Kindle format. So I was like, well, I'm not a good direction follower. So I figured, I don't want to go through these four pages or whatever of specs from Amazon. Let me just go and see how cheap I can outsource this thing. And so there are a number of people that are doing it for $5. In some cases, they charge more depending on how many words you have. But you can get people to do it for $5 on Fiverr still.
And has that been selling well?
Yeah, it's I wasn't sure how that would work out, but it's I guess it's depending on what kind of category you're going into, pretty much anybody can claim that they got there, but it's hit number one for both direct marketing and web marketing on Amazon, and it's been top of the charts for those things at different times in all the various country versions of Amazon all around the world. So it's been selling nicely, and I've been very happy with it, so I think I'll probably jump back into that and do some more publishing on Kindle.
Cool.
Yeah, it's nice too, just to get some extra pocket change for some content that I could churn out so quick and easy.
Yeah, right. Cool. Well, anything else you want to share?
No, but I think that's it. And I guess if anybody ever wanted to reach me, I try to be very accessible, so I'm available. My name on Twitter is Affiliate Tip. It's my name on Facebook, Sean, Shawn Collins, and I blog every day at blog.affiliatetip.com on affiliate marketing. So, my email is either Sean, Shawn, at affiliatesummit.com or the same Sean at affiliatetip.com.
Awesome.
So happy to hear from people.
Well, Sean, thanks very much for doing the interview.
Thank you. It's been a great time.